The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. Good evening. Welcome, welcome. So, I don't know if this has ever happened to any of you. This has happened to me a number of times. I pick up my phone, maybe to give me a notification that a message that I was maybe expecting or something. Pick up my phone to look at it. Just a quick check, you know, like, okay, just want to see how this is. And then I stay on the phone. There's a certain amount of like scrolling that keeps on happening, and then minute after minute after minute is passing, and then here I am on this, oh, I better check my this and that, and I don't know, for some reason I'm so interested in the World Cup these days. I never was interested in this before, but now that it's here in our neighborhood, I'm like so interested in how this works and who's playing who and how that's going. So it's not like there's this big ethical breach or terrible mistake or anything like this. It's just a human, ordinary moment. I mean, you all know, right? Our phones are designed to be difficult to put down. A lot of people get paid a lot of money to make sure that it's difficult to put down, which is okay. I mean, that's their job. It doesn't mean that we have to let them do their job well, though, or in some kind of way. But maybe there's something important that has happened in this moment where, in my case, I'm still on the phone checking this or that, you know, longer than I initially intended to. And that is that the mind has just been carried along without wisdom, without presence. It's just been carried along. And, you know, it seems, you know, not like a big deal, but this exact same movement that we see there with the phone, with our staying on the phone longer than we intend to, this happens again and again and again. The same movement of, we could say something that wisdom is maybe a little bit behind what's actually happening. It's not right there in the moment. And in this example of the phone, it's maybe doesn't feel like suffering, but there is a way in which suffering can be defined as just a very subtle feeling of like, this moment's not quite right. And maybe it's just a subtle feeling that we don't even articulate so clearly, even know so clearly. So there's a way in which maybe we could say the suffering moves faster than the wisdom. And we could say that part of practice is to help bring these together so that wisdom can help understand and untangle, dissect and pull apart, or some way create the conditions in which the suffering, quote-unquote, doesn't arise. So again, I'm using this word suffering, just this feeling of something's not quite right, and therefore I'm going to distract myself with my phone or something like this. But also, I mean, suffering means just the real terrible feeling. Sometimes the way we can be so mean to ourselves, and we're just beating ourselves up, saying like, oh, I should be doing it better. Those people over there are doing it better, or whatever it happens to be. So there's this way in which meditation practice helps us to maybe slow things down so that the wisdom can catch up, so to speak. Slow things down so that we can see more clearly what's actually happening there. Not so that we can judge ourselves, not so that we can try to control everything, not so that we can pat ourselves on the back, like, okay, yeah, I see this, I got it, I know it, but as a way for us to find more freedom, as a way for us to find more peace and more ease in our life. I think that's why all of us come to practice, not to necessarily master some techniques, memorize some lists, or, you know, something like this. It's just so our life can unfold with more ease, more peace, so we can have more freedom. In whatever way that you understand these words. So I'd like to offer a few frameworks that we might use to help us kind of like see what's happening in those moments when suffering, quote-unquote, dukkha, is there and wisdom isn't quite there yet in our experience. So one thing that these, I'll say one framework that I'll introduce helps us to recognize what has taken over the mind. Like if wisdom isn't there, what is there? And then another framework that can help us appreciate, well, how can we grow wisdom? How can we create the conditions in which wisdom develops and is more readily available and is more present for our experience? So in that ordinary moment of scrolling on the phone that I described earlier, we can begin to see what we might think of as secret agents. I'm saying this just to be a little bit playful, this idea of secret agents in the mind, otherwise known as kleshas, otherwise known as unwholesome qualities, otherwise known as defilements. But I don't like this word defilements. It makes me feel like we're dirty in some kind of way, or, you know, there's something terrible about what is a perfectly human, perfectly natural experience that everybody has until they're completely awakened. Kleshas, unwholesome qualities, defilements, secret agents. And so these secret agents, there's three of them. Typically is the way in the Buddhist framework we offer them. And it can be helpful to narrow things down to these three. One is, often we use this word, greed. Second is aversion. And the third is delusion. So whenever wisdom is not present, one of these three things is present. Greed, aversion, delusion. And they move quickly. And they're often like underneath, kind of like the conscious mind. And they move quickly and are influencing actions, things that we say, things that we do, or they're influencing, you know, the next bout of thoughts that we find ourselves being lost in. So there's this way we can understand greed as reaching for stimulation. Maybe the next thing will be more interesting. Or this idea that maybe there's something that I need to know in the case of being on the phone, or this sense of reaching for, okay, well, maybe this next thing will finally be satisfying, or maybe this next thing will be a lasting source of happiness or something like this. So greed is this idea of reaching for something. Aversion, we could say, is resisting. It's this opposite. Is resisting boredom, resisting uncertainty, resisting a certain task, a certain feeling, a conversation that we need to have. There's, you know, it's endless, the things that we can resist. So the second of these secret agents is resisting. And then the third delusion is about the way in which we're trying to make it seem reasonable. We're trying to, like, justify what we're doing in this way of this example I gave of me being on the phone is, you know, just as, yeah, it's important for me to be informed about the scores of the World Cup, or, you know, informed of what the weather is going to be tomorrow. You know, often I don't really need to know what the weather is going to be until I'm actually going to leave my house, so I know right then. But, you know, these types of things that we are justifying our behavior. Or maybe we're telling ourselves, yeah, this helps me relax. Things that often don't help us relax. or this, it's just, I just need one more minute. I just need one more minute. And, you know, that turns into quite a few more minutes. So there's this way in which we're telling ourselves, oh, this is harmless. This is useful. This is necessary. Even though we're not really seeing things clearly. We're not really connected to what's actually happening. All we're really doing is trying to justify the reaching or the resisting. Just trying to make ourselves feel better about that. So this idea of introducing this framework or this teaching, it's not about blaming ourselves. As I said, this is what humans have. And part of, for me, what I find helpful and supportive about these Buddhist teachings is it helps normalize kind of like the human experience and puts language around what all of us are experiencing. And with this language, with this recognition, there's a way in which we can stop blaming ourselves and start maybe just being present for what's actually happening so that we can learn about it. Can we learn? How does this arise? And we can maybe start to see how quickly the mind will start to go a certain direction. That justification likes to slip in there. And this way, a small, ordinary, mundane moment, being on the phone longer than one expects to, can actually create the conditions, and we can start to see how suffering is created. Might not feel like suffering when we're on the phone, but it's the exact same mechanism. And it's so much easier to look at in something mundane than the phone than the terrible heartbreak that we're experiencing, which so often we tip into overwhelm when we first starting to look at it, the grief that we're experiencing or the anger that we have. There can be some real skill and wisdom into looking at some of these mundane activities. So is there a way that we can maybe slow down the moment enough that we can understand it and see what's actually happening? So one way in which this framework of the three kleshas, the three unwholesome qualities, the three defilements, the three secret agents, why is it helpful? As I said, maybe, you know, it helps us to, maybe it's, when we're looking at it, when we're using this framework, it helps maybe simplify things. Sometimes when we're like in the midst of difficulty, it just feels like a black box or it just feels like a morass of ickiness. And maybe we don't even have words. We just have this sense like, get this away from me. I don't want it. You know, just a lot of resistance or a sense of like, oh, I need this. I need this. A lot of reaching. And so sometimes it can be really helpful just to recognize, oh, yeah, resistance is here. That somehow turns this what can be this complicated mixture of bodily sensations, thoughts, and movements and actions, and just simplify it to resistance. And it can be okay to just be that simple, or reaching for greed, or this way we're justifying, we're trying to make it reasonable. And so instead of trying to like figure out exactly what's happening when we're feeling overwhelmed or when it feels like too much, we can instead just tune into, for some people this will be helpful, not for everybody, we can tune into, is there like a movement of the mind? Is there this no, this resistance, or a I want more, I need more, a reaching? Or is there this sense of a lot of justification and reasonableness? In this way, we can move from the content, I can't believe they said this. The next time I say that I'm going to do this, I better send an email that does that. Or maybe I should change my living situation in some kind of way. Or, you know, the way that our stories can be so complicated. So instead of the story, the content about what's actually happening, the particulars about what's happening, we shift to the process, this movement, resisting, reaching, making something reasonable, and letting the content take care of itself. It's hard to do this initially. It takes a little bit of practice, but it turns out to be so helpful. If we don't feel like we have to fix and figure out everything, we can just simplify resisting, reaching, trying to make it reasonable, the resisting and reaching. So that's one way that using this framework of these three kleshas, these three unwholesome qualities, these three secret agents, is we can use it to just simplify things. But a second advantage or benefit of using this framework is it can help reduce identification. Instead of saying, oh, I'm just a greedy person, look, here I am again trying to, I want this and I want that and I want this other thing and I already have all these things in my Amazon shopping cart and you know whatever it might be. Instead of saying, oh, I'm such a greedy person, it can be like, oh, the experience of greed is here. It's a clunky language. The experience of greed is here. But wowee, does it feel different? The experience of wanting more and more and more is here. The experience of reaching is being known. So it turns it into an experience, which it is. And it drops this whole idea of what it means about me, what it means about you, what it means about anybody as a person. It just means greed is here right now. And the mind is going to protest. It's going to say, no, 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 we need this thing. We have to identify ourselves with this. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. You don't need it. So I admit this is awkward and clunky language, but if you try it for yourself, you'll just feel how different it is. We can see this with our emotions, like, oh, I'm a sad person. Instead of saying, yep, sadness is being experienced. The second one is true, is real, is what's actually happening. The other one is a story that we're making up. You know, it's data to support the story. I'm not saying that it's 100% inaccurate, but we don't have to create a story about ourselves. We don't have to make it mean anything about ourselves. So that's the second benefit of using this framework of the three kleshas, the three unwholesome qualities, the three secret agents. And a third one is, if we can start to see that these three kleshas points to where wisdom can be a support. Because there's this way in which we start to see, oh, the difficulty, the uncomfortableness is not only about the experience out there, that email that arrived with the sharp tone, for example, or didn't answer the question that we specifically asked, but instead talked about other things, or, you know, or just a message of sad news or whatever it might be. So when we start to use this framework of the three kleshas, then we start to see, oh, the difficulty isn't in object, the thing over there, in this, for example, this email, it's an experience that's being had over here. It's not inherent to the email. The email is just a bunch of words on a screen. I mean, it's possible that a person could read the exact same email and go, oh, okay, and then go to the next one. Or they could read like, oh, okay, I'll put that in the task list. That needs some careful attention. I'm really not present right now. I'll pay attention to that when I have more time. Instead of it arrives and we're like, oh my gosh, this is terrible and I have to do something about it and I have to, right? There's just so many different ways in which we can react. And so looking at the kleshas helps us to see, oh yeah, the aversion, the desire, or the delusion is here in the mind. It's not actually in the experience, the object out there. So it's also pointing to when we start to see that these greed, aversion, or delusion are present, it also highlights where there isn't wisdom. Because greed, aversion, and delusion in some kind of way are pointing to, oh, a lasting source of happiness will be just right over there. And it never quite comes up. There might be happiness, right? But it's not lasting in the way that we want it to be. So it's a way in which this framework of these three kleshas can also point out where wisdom has an opportunity where we could help shift the suffering, help us learn about ourselves, help to create the conditions in which something else might happen. So then the second framework I'd like to introduce is, well, okay, if wisdom is so helpful, then how does it develop? How do we get this wisdom thing? How does wisdom help our life unfold in a way in which there's less suffering? So there's a way in which we might think that meditation is about, you know, becoming calm, maybe having particular meditative experiences. I heard somebody use this phrase once that I really liked, becoming a bliss blob. Just hanging out, feeling nothing really, but just happy or something. And to be sure, meditation can support having lots of sense of well-being, tremendous, like just unimaginable amounts of well-being, absolutely. And it helps relaxation. But this tremendous sense of well-being comes from when wisdom has a role with that. And so I would say, actually, the purpose, or I guess I'll use this word purpose for a mindfulness practice, meditation practice, is to help to create the conditions in which wisdom can arise. And so, how does that work? So here's a framework you might be able to use. Moments of mindfulness are noticing what's actually happening. There's discomfort in the knee. There's pressure against the body where it's sitting in my case, on this cushion. There's sounds. There's a thought of like, what am I going to say next? These are just events, right? One event after another, a bodily event, mental events. And so mindfulness is like meeting this and kind of like collecting data, if you want to say. In this particular framework, I'm going to use this language. Mindfulness is just collecting data. What's actually happening right now? Very simple. Physical events, mental events. And that's it. That's all that life is. Physical events, mental events. Physical includes, you know, our five senses, and then mental events are the mind. So then this framework, Saidao Utejaniya, he uses this language of collecting data, and then something like knowledge kind of like organizes the data and starts to say, oh yeah, okay, this is physical, you know, pressure or feeling the clothing against the body or hearing sound. And these other ones are mental thoughts, views, attitudes, emotions have both mental and physical. But there's this way in which knowledge can kind of like categorize them. And there's a reason why it's helpful to make a distinction between physical and mental. Physical events are what's actually happening right now. They're tangible, they're real, it's what's happening right now. Whereas mental ones, the events are happening now, but so often we're lost in the content. rehashing the past, rehearsing the future. And so they have a different quality because we're lost in them. They are happening in the present moment, but we don't know that we're in the present moment because we're lost in thought in the past or the future. Not only that, are they not in the present moment? Thoughts are, they're intangible, insubstantial. They have, I mean, like, how many thoughts have you had just since you arrived here at IMC? A lot. I'm sure you've had thoughts during meditation. You had thoughts during this talk, like, wait, what? Or something like this, right? They just come and go, come and go, come and go. It's amazing how many thoughts we have. And yet some of them, right, we just like grab and say, okay, no, this one's true. This one's true. All the 10 bazillion quadrillion, all the other ones, I don't know about those, but you know, this one is true. But it's fascinating how we do this, how we give authority to particular thoughts and kind of like ignore the rest or something like this. This is a topic for a whole other talk, but just to notice that the experience is different between physical and mental. Do not underestimate how helpful this can be. So often we're just lost in thought and kind of like disowning the body, but the body is here and now and can be a tremendous support. So mindfulness is collecting data. We're going to use this word knowledge, is categorizing the data into physical and mental. And then we might say wisdom is starting to recognize relationships between these, between the mental and the physical, and between physical and mental and mental. It's just all of the relationships. And starting to recognize, oh yeah, causes and conditions. When I don't sleep very much the night before, I tend to be cranky the next day, and my emails are short, and maybe I have a little bit more of a bite to them. If I haven't drank enough liquids during the day, I'm dehydrated, or then I don't have a lot of energy. But there's all these ways in which we often am not noticing how this leads to that, leads to that, leads to that. Again, in the mundane and in the complicated things. Because suffering, the difficulties of our life are constructed, they're created, they're not just completely out of thin air. That doesn't exist. Nothing's completely out of thin air. That's just not possible. So wisdom comes from data and knowledge. So mindfulness practice helps collect the data. Knowledge helps us kind of like organize it. And then wisdom allows us to start to see the relationship between them. Because if there are things that are supporting the creation of suffering, there's things that can support the uncreation of suffering. Or maybe we can do the work with those things, the conditions. Maybe we can't undo this difficulty, but we can notice, oh yeah, I'm going to just try sleeping more, eating better, drinking more, not reading emails when I only have a few minutes, or whatever it is for you, whatever kind of suffering thing there is. It's arising because there's a lot of things supporting it. So we might not control this first moment of anger or fear or wanting or confusion. That's the first arrow. Those of you who are familiar with Buddhist teachings, this is what's, life often just shoots us with arrows and it's painful. But wisdom begins to see how what we're doing keeps the experience going, because nothing keeps going, right? We know that things arise and pass away, impermanence. So why things are painful for as long as we are. There's something that's prolonging it or perpetuating it. And wisdom often can start to see that, oh yeah, it's because there's this resistance. I'm trying to control it and make it go away, and therefore I'm entangled up in it and unknowingly prolonging it, even though I'm trying to make this uncomfortable experience go away. So wisdom is a way that could be asking, what's feeding this suffering? What's underneath it? What's making it stay here longer? As I said, often we never control what, you know, life is bringing us, the first things. But wisdom is pointing to, okay, this things arise and pass away, and it's been here for quite some time. What's feeding this? What's fueling this? So there's this way in which wisdom starts to maybe understand the relationship between what the mind brings and what the body brings. And then you might say, well, what's so helpful about this framework of recognizing that it goes from mindfulness, which is data, I'm using the word knowledge for organizing the data, and then wisdom that can like start to see the what's prolonging the suffering. Hint, it's usually in the mind. But there's this way of recognizing it for just to have it these three steps just helps reduce the shame, this way in which this sense of self kind of shows up like, oh, I shouldn't still be having difficulty around this. What's wrong with me? I've been meditating for so long and I'm still having this experience. Instead, we can just say, oh, it's a three-step process. Awareness, knowledge, wisdom, data, organization, seeing the relationship. And then when we just say, like, okay, it's a three-step process, maybe there's some curiosity that can be brought in. Instead of like, oh, I should know better. Why is this still happening to me? I'll never be able to stop this. Maybe there's this way that curiosity can support this inquiry. What's fueling this? What's feeding this? What's happening right now? So this idea of frameworks are a way to maybe simplify and depersonalize, make it something that's not, they're not mistakes, it's not something terrible. But I also want to say they're not the point, like these frameworks, I'm just offering them as maybe like tools or something that can be useful. Practice isn't about becoming experts in categories. Practice is about freedom. How can we have less suffering? How can we have more ease? How can we have more peace? And so I offer these as two, I'm using the word frameworks, that can support us approaching or being with our experience when it feels uncomfortable, when it feels like it's too much. So maybe in any moment of suffering we find ourselves in, any moment of dukkha, we can begin simply. We can ask, what's being noticed? What parts can be distinguished, physical and mental? Maybe we can ask, is the mind reaching or resisting or trying to make something be reasonable? I like this alliteration of reaching, resisting, reasonable. And then, little by little, moment by moment, the mind starts to really understand and see how suffering is constructed, created, what's underneath it. And with that, this opens the door to freedom. I can stop. We can see, like, oh, we don't need to do this. There's something about when the mind starts to really understand something deeply, there's this way in which letting go just naturally happens. We don't have to force it to happen. So this way then, which we can understand that dukkha can be known, it can be softened, and it can be released. Help us find more peace, ease, and freedom. So I'll stop there. Thank you. And now I'd like to open it up to see if there's some comments or questions.
What's the best way to do contemplation? Is it like, you know, like conscious thinking? Would it be do mindfulness meditation for like 15 minutes and then maybe enter into some contemplation?
Yeah, can you say a little bit more about contemplation? Like, what do you mean?
Like, you know, all the stuff you were talking about, right? It requires some thought. I mean, some mental energy, right?
Yeah.
So what would be the best way to go about using that and doing that?
Yeah. Thank you. This is a good question. Exactly as you said, I would say meditate for a certain while, allow there to be a certain settledness. And then one way to do some of this inquiry, like what's fueling this, what's feeding this, for example, is to just drop in the question, what's feeding this? And then don't look for it. Because looking for it, that's becomes a whole different project. And then, so we're just creating the conditions for the answer to bubble up. Often the answers do bubble up. Sometimes they don't. And that's okay too. So it's not like we have to find the answer right there. It's just the activity of asking is actually already changes like the inner ecosystem. We're no longer lost in it. We are now bringing some curiosity to it. So just simply doing the asking has tremendous value. And sometimes the answer bubbles up and sometimes it doesn't.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. And I've been thinking about this greed, resistance, and delusion. And to me, at least, it seems they are qualitatively different. Because with greed, I have some agency. I'm capable of putting down that phone and even laugh at myself wanting to scroll. With delusions, I have a mind, and that again, I have some agency. I can recognize delusion, and that helps. But aversion feels qualitatively different to me, and I'm not quite clear. I'm not sure if I'm thinking clearly about this, because I have no agency, at least in my definition of this resistance, which says I don't want this. And so,
yeah. So thank you for pointing this out. So not everybody's the same. So some people will say, yeah, okay, delusion is not a problem for me, or I have, that's the one where I feel like I don't have agency, or, I mean, so different people have different, of these three, they have different relationships to them. And the Buddhist teachings would say, and which I tend to agree, that actually we don't have the agency we think we do with these three, with all three of them. Some of them may feel more familiar. Some of them may feel like we get less caught by. But what the teachings are trying to point to is like these are just really underneath everything that isn't wisdom. Everything. If it's not wisdom, it has some version of one of these. And I'm going like this with my hand because say like, you know, underneath what's there. But so you're saying that you feel like you don't have agency. Some other people would say, oh, yeah, I have plenty of agency with resistance or aversion, but not with greed or something like this.
Okay, so it's personal, perhaps.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
And right behind you.
So I'm wondering about the relationship between greed and attachment.
Can you define how you're using attachments? Mm.
So one of the things I found helpful is the concept of attachment is like something I can let go of. It's like I can identify when I'm having urgency about something and I'm attached to it and I can recognize it. I can do that slow down and go, oh, attachment, like I can do that. With greed, I'm not sure if that's the same thing or...
I think I would say so. You know, we don't, there's a way in which we could get really technical, and that's not really the way that I practice
the concept
or teach.
I'm just trying, yeah.
Yeah, it's the same. They're the same. There's just this general movement. Oh, I want this or need this. This will be a lasting source of happiness.
Yeah.
And this, it gets, shows up as greed, clinging, attachment, tanha, upadana. There's all these different words. They're all just pointing to this same movement.
So sometimes it's hard to tell whether it's aversion or attachment. Like, just a petty example. So scrubbing the sink when I know I should be leaving for work. I can't sometimes... How do you figure out...
Yeah. Thank you for asking this question. They're always related. It's impossible for them not to be, I would say. It's so interesting how they are just two sides of the same coin. And as I was saying earlier, some people tend to notice one side more than the other side. And so maybe it's helpful to just notice that. But maybe, I think maybe what's most helpful is to recognize that what's really underneath that, whether it's a desire or aversion, is this view that things should be different or could be different. That's kind of that's what's fueling however it gets experienced. And that's what's fascinating. When we get down to see that, oh yeah, we always have this idea. Wait, this needs to be different. I want it to be different. It shouldn't be like this. And rarely is it so clearly articulated. It's just this subtle feeling like, no, it should be like this, how I want it to be or how I think it should be or whatever.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So thank you for your kind attention. Wishing you a wonderful rest of the evening and safe travels home. Thank you. If you'd like, you're welcome to come up here and ask a question or say something.